I've written four books, and my fifth is about to come out, and I'm celebrating that with the launch event at Asia House on the 27th of January, which I'm very much looking forward to because it's been about 2.5 years since I published my last book, which was a reportage from Palestine. So this new book needs a new party and a new event and new discussion.
Tell me more about that. What's this new book about?
I did several months of outreach work with asylum seekers and refugees, and I'm still doing that. In fact, I have a new run of workshops this year, and they were the most wonderful, funny, exciting experienced people I'd ever met. And I thought, I've got to share their stories, because it seems to me that asylum seekers and refugees are society's invisible individuals, that they're spoken about, but no one hears from them directly. So it was about the outreach and the stories I heard, and it was also a little bit about the challenges of doing that kind of work. I mean, someone once said to me at a reading, what gives you the right to write this book? And she was absolutely right. I don't have any particular right to do it, except that I've got a platform. So I can publish a book about it. I've got that ability to write something and have it read by at least a few people.
This is a relevant topic at the minute. So was this a conscious decision to come out with this book now?
I didn't time it exactly. I have to say I'm quite lucky that we're in the run-up to the elections. And so immigration and migration and asylum and exile and refuge, all of which tend to get bundled together, are now very much in the public debate. But even 3 years ago, when I began doing this kind of work, you would open the tabloids and there'd be these horrendous news articles basically scapegoating asylum seekers for just any crime in the world. I remember being in the dentist, and I said to this very friendly dentist who I've gone to for ages, you know, I've noticed that you've got loads of security around here. And she said, oh yeah, Romanian gangs have been robbing the high street. And I looked at it and I thought, I bet they haven't. And organized crime in this country is 99% committed by people from this country. But there's just the sense of vilification of anyone who was foreign and a complete absence of interest in what their stories really were. A few years ago, if you were a migrant or a refugee from Eastern Europe, you may well be fleeing a post-Soviet downfall of your economy. You might be fleeing the Bosnian War. You'd be fleeing violence, but nobody seems to ask. It's as though the story of asylum begins when people arrive here.
So what more do you think could be done for refugees?
I think funding is a major issue. At the moment, I know from my research that the so-called austerity measures, which are the best euphemism I've ever heard in my life, the government have severely cut funding to services for those who are already the poorest. So funding to legal aid, charities, public services, social services. And that has put everyone, and particularly those at the very bottom of the scale, at genuine risk of destitution. So the people I worked with were surviving on about £5 or £6 a day maximum. And they were existing due to the kindness of charities and strangers. That leaves you open to exploitation. Women for Refugee Women, which is a fantastic charity, did some research on this. And it showed that women in particular would find themselves in horrendous situations, such as being offered a room and then after about a week being expected to give up sexual labour for it or look after someone's kids or do cooking and cleaning. So the kindness became exploitation.
You'll be speaking more about this at Asia House.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to this because I think what tends to happen is when you talk about asylum, it becomes a debate. And there's people in the audience who just say, well, send them all back home. And this is not about that. So we're going to have Maurice Wren, who's the CEO of the Refugee Council. So he really knows what he's talking about. And then we're going to be chaired by Rachel Holmes, who's a historian and an activist, very, very active in the fight against AIDS and towards AIDS research and against apartheid. She's South African. So I think that we're going to move away from vilification and start talking about what is the reality of being an asylum seeker in this country.
I want you to take me back to when it all began. When did you first realise that being a journalist and an author was a career for you?
I'm really lucky because I've been around for a disgustingly long time. I've had a career since I was 14, and I remember saying that I wanted to be a journalist when I was 13. And before then, I really wanted to be a designer. And I remember saying that as a little kid to my headmistress, and her face just dropped because I've always been to these very upscale schools, and I think they thought that a designer was like a dress designer on the high street, like you'd be making wedding dresses for the neighbourhood. And I don't regret not going into design. I still work in magazines a lot as an art director. But I think journalism was the thing for me. I was always good at English without trying. And I never quite understood why I got good marks. And I think that somehow in your career you have to do what you do best naturally. It's a thing that you do without even thinking about it. And I loved meeting people. And the great thing about being a journalist is that me talking to you constitutes work today, which I think is hilarious. Whereas to me it's like a coffee with a new friend. But this is what journalism's about. It's about communication. And I wasn't shy.
And is this what drew you towards the career?
Yeah, I think so. It was the desire to meet people. It's the desire to meet all different kinds of person. And with journalism, you are uniquely placed to do that. I've worked in Palestine, I've worked in asylum, I've worked in things like style and fashion magazines. And just having that press card or that identity gets you into places which you wouldn't ordinarily get into. And you realise that people are all the same. They're the friendly ones, there are the shy ones, there are the ones who you don't want to know. But those divisions break down a little bit when you're a journalist.
And were your parents supportive of your career choice?
I am from an incredibly supportive background, and only now in my 30s do I realise how important that is, because I meet people from all walks of life who didn't have that level of support. But nobody ever said to me, why do you want to do that? Your kind of person doesn't do that. A woman doesn't do that. Someone who's this class doesn't do that. You should be this, that, or the other. There was just constant support. And also, I think, I mean, my mum is the real driver of my family. And she thought that what I was doing was basically really cool. So it wasn't in this kind of mummy maternal sense. I think she really kind of liked it and appreciated it. And she's a computer scientist, and she's absolutely a role model for me. But I remember when I got my first assignments, I was about 14, 15, and I got a letter back from a music magazine saying, oh, your work is nice, and because I sent them some stuff. And I remember sitting on the stairs waiting for her to come home from work. And she came in the door, and I said, Mum, I've got a career. And she's like, what? And I said, this magazine wrote back to me, and she had no idea that I'd sent off my stuff to magazines, but I was very confident, and that confidence comes from having a supportive background.
See, I'm interested in how you were viewed as this outsider when you had this loving family.
I mean, I look back on my career and it seems so epic from the outside. And of course, when you're in your career, it doesn't feel like anything. It feels like just your daily life. But I was definitely the first Asian woman, girl, actually working on all these music magazines. I would go into these offices and there were like no women and no non-white people whatsoever. And I succeeded precisely because I'm a woman's woman. I really wanted to write about these cool girl musicians and artists and designers who were out at the time. And I look back and I think, oh my God, I must have looked like this total alien when I walked into this place.
Was that difficult for you?
Well, at the time I was not, it's not that I was confident, although I was, but I was completely unshy and everything was a novelty. So I'd walk into these offices and everything would be like, oh, this is fabulous. I'm going to a gig. It's all marvellous. I'm going to a gallery opening. It's all fantastic.
Was that age or ambition?
I think it was age. I think that when you're 14, your brain's basically made of mush and you have no idea that what you're doing is pioneering in any way. It's all just enormous fun. And with journalism, because it's such a social job, I would be invited to, let's say, a fashion show. And you could take your friends. You could genuinely take your two friends from school and mess about, as long as you wrote it up afterwards in an adult, analytical, intelligent way. So it was just a blast. I did not ever have a tough time. And again, I think that comes from family. If you're invested in by the people around you when you're growing up, you don't find life difficult. And I love being in this room and this nice minty walls. I mean, I think everything is stylish and wonderful and everyone's lovely. Having said that, I'm sure I hit lots of glass ceilings. I'm not sure I broke that many glass ceilings. I mean, even on the first music magazine I worked on, I rose very, very quickly. And women who were also on staff came up to me and said, look, you know the guy who does the features, he discriminates against women. I tell you what's going to happen. He'll commission something and then he'll sort of analyze it until it disappears, and then he's going to put it on the back burner. And this is exactly what happened to me. Exactly as it had been described. is what happened to me. So I hit my first glass ceiling when I was 15. And it was astonishing. And I don't know if it was conscious. I don't know if this guy realized he was doing it. But he had done it to all of the very few women that were in the office, regardless of color. And they had all warned me. And their warning was true. It was correct. And I look back on that, but I have a little satisfaction in the sense that I've never heard from this person since. A lot of people became collateral damage. I think journalism is a hard career. And there are all these shifts like the digital revolution. And if you don't get it together, you become collateral damage. A lot of my colleagues from the last 20 years, I don't hear their names. I think that the industry is in free fall, and that's been abetted by the global recession and the fall in ad revenues. It's very interesting, but it's quite scary.
What was it like entering the limelight at such a young age?
I have very, very mixed feelings about fame. And again, being 20 years older than I was when I first cut that first book deal at the age of 16, and suddenly being in very mainstream papers, so I was on the cover of The Telegraph with a little picture, and having met lots of people who are famous and semi-famous in all sorts of fields, and also interviewing a lot through the BBC, I've just come to the conclusion that people who want to be famous have some sort of childhood validation issue, because being famous isn't nice. And so I cut my first book deal when I was 16. I'd already been a journalist for 2 years before then. And being a journalist is fun. Being famous in papers is not fun. And I found it incredibly exposing and very objectifying and oddly violating, even though it wasn't. I mean, this is a sort of extreme reaction in my brain, but I don't think that human beings are there to be photographed and then to have the photograph reproduced so that other people can buy papers. Having said all of that, cutting that first book deal was genuinely useful at a career level. It does open doors. It means that when you have another project, everything doesn't slam shut in your face. So it was useful and it was very interesting.
Sort of mutual exploitation.
It is, but it puts you further into the industry at a career level. So I love that aspect because I always wanted to be a player behind the scenes, not some sort of object that's in front of the scenes. And I felt that a lot of the interest at that time was to do with not my book. So it was to do with being very young. I was unbelievably good looking at that age. And I look back and I'm like, oh my God, you should have used that instead of like ignoring it. So there were these huge pictures with a tiny article. And it was all very, very strange. But I am ambivalent about it. And I also understand what people mean when they say that fame is very addictive, because you have this burst of attention. It genuinely helps a book. It makes you realize that lots of books that come out and don't do very well probably just didn't have the marketing behind them, because people do act. If you put a big picture and a little mention of a book and you say, well, you can buy it in Waterstones now, or now it'll be Amazon, people do go and buy it. And I think that that level of early success also makes you expect that throughout your career. Luckily for me, I'm in literature, so I don't write with my face. It doesn't really matter what I look like. I think it can be really devastating if you're that famous that young and it's sort of tied up with your look. So if you're a model or an actor or a dancer, I think that can be really devastating, because these people go off the rails. They go really mad. I mean, I didn't go mad, but I wasted a lot of money. I wasted all the money I made before I was 21. I became very inward looking, very hyper aware of suddenly being in the entertainment industry.
So what did you learn about yourself on that journey?
I learned that I feel very ambivalent towards fiction. I learned that the publishing industry is a branch of the entertainment industry, and it's about selling product. And that was a very uncomfortable realization, because you sign this deal and suddenly you meet marketing people and they're trying to get other people to buy your product. It's not the same as being a journalist where you make a comment about something. This is about selling a product. And you suddenly are put in a position of competitiveness with other writers. I don't feel competitive with other writers. I have no interest. I'm not going to compete with other women. I have no interest in competing with men or talking about that at all. And if your book does well or doesn't do well, suddenly you're supposed to better it or match it. So I feel very ambivalent, and it put me off fiction for a really long time. Only now am I getting back into fiction. I was with HarperCollins, and I miss being with a big corporation. I mean, I love all of these small public, you know, publishing companies that do little short stories and stuff, but, you know, I believe in corporations, basically.
You were just 16 years old when you signed this major book deal. Did it feel like you were in your own little bubble?
I think there probably was a protective bubble around me, which I didn't realise at the time. And then, like all 16-year-olds, I began acting out in this stupid way. I didn't realise that my mum and my agent had actually spoken to each other behind my back and were really looking after me. And the same with the agent and the publishing company. I didn't know any of that. And, of course, I look back now and I realise, oh, God, you were so young and naive. And the first novel came out and it did really well, but I thought that it hadn't done well because, to me, a bestseller is like Danielle Steele or J.K. Rowling or Stephen King or someone like that. You know, you're very visible. And I became very embarrassed and I thought that the publishing company were disappointed in me, which is so awful. And I should have said all of this, but I sort of didn't because, you know, you don't. And then I self-sabotaged quite badly and I lost this fantastic agent. I lost these great publishers. And I never quite got back that element of my career. I did very well in journalism after that because I went into the BBC and became a presenter. But fiction-wise, I'm still at the stage of thinking, God, you know, how am I going to get back? Should I write Brown Game of Thrones? Which is actually my secret fantasy to do. I want to do a brown female Game of Thrones.
I think you should do it.
Hunger Game of Thrones, or Herinda Pottergy, as I call it.
Well, I would read that. That was a rebellious stage, wasn't it, in your life? Are you still viewed as this rebellious writer?
I think that what happens is whatever you become known for at the beginning sticks with you forever. So I'm 36. I'm really happy being 36. But I'm still treated as though I'm this very young newcomer, very punky, very fierce. Actually, I'm incredibly 70s-style, militant, radical feminist. But I'm small-c conservative, and of course I have all that class privilege, which makes you entitled, and it pegs you at a certain level class-wise. So I'm not a rebel in any other sense but my gender and race politics. But I think also that I've managed to survive, and I think I'm respected. Part of the reason I'm treated well by the media and when books of mine come out is because I work in the media. So that mitigates against me being misrepresented, because if anyone tries to do that, I will bump into them at a meeting 5 days later. They can't do that anymore. I'm now a trustee of the Booker Prize Foundation, which is seriously establishment stuff, and I'm learning about how power works. I'm quite appalled by how power works, actually, because I've come to the conclusion that we live in the Tudors. We might have iPhones and we wear different clothes, but power is concentrated in the hands of the few. And it's secretive. And if you want to make a change, then being an outward rebel actually doesn't work. You have to somehow subvert and advocate for change at a very kind of civilized, covert level. So I'm enjoying time passing. I'm enjoying growing up, actually.
Do you still have your tattoos?
Yeah, these tattoos are never going to be removed. It ends, I've just shown you my wrist and it ends up here. So my left arm is totally covered and the right arm has a small tattoo on the forearm, which it's the only one that I don't regret because it was the first one. So I got my first tattoo when I was 15. And to me, it was a symbol of my career flowering. And I'm so happy every time I see it because it reminds me of how happy I was at 15. I somehow knew that I was onto something. I was so happy. Life was so exciting. And the sleeve on the left, it's never going to go because laser tattoo removal doesn't work very well on dark skin. But I'm very comfortable with it now, and I also realise that our generation has just got loads of really rubbish tattoos. So many. Every time, if you go to the beach, you'll see that nearly everyone of a certain age bracket has a rubbish tattoo, and mine is so not the very worst. So I don't mind it at all. Yeah, I've embraced it, and I think it's stupid to be neurotic about your looks.
Who were your influences?
People who influence me now are the women I know who've had very, very long careers. I really admire Arundhati Roy, actually, because she started off as this novelist who became famous very quickly, and she clearly quite consciously rejected that and decided that her interest was in human rights activism. She could have so easily knocked out another novel, made loads of money, been in magazines, but she's fighting the good fight. She's a critical thinker, and I really admire that. I admire people like Kirsty Walk, who I know a little bit through the BBC, and I've seen her present the first half of Newsnight doing five items about five different international stories, news stories, cross over and then do five items about the arts and culture. And the sheer brain ability that you need to be able to do that just totally impresses and amazes me. When I was a teenager, I didn't have influences as such. I mean, I was very involved in the world, but I didn't have anyone in mind. I was working on pure inspiration and pure instinct to the point where I look back now and I think, oh my God, where did that come from? That ability, that sheer drive, and very good business sense, very good strategic sense, but it was all kind of innate. And then you get older, you get much more circumspect, and you double think everything, and you bear in mind all different kinds of outcomes. When you're a teenager, I was that classic sort of suburban person who wants to get into town and have a fun, glamorous, interesting life. And I didn't know that much. I certainly wasn't a bookworm in any way whatsoever. I was an artworm. I used to go to galleries all the time. I was never a bookworm. I didn't know anything about publishing or the media.
There's a lady who's written four books.
I know.
Let's journey back to your time at both newspapers and magazines. What did you prefer?
I worked in magazines very heavily as a teenager until the age of about, let's say, 23 or 24. And while I'm incredibly critical about the fashion industry and the style industry, I think it's sexist, racist, exploitative in all sorts of ways. If you're a teenager and you want to be a journalist, I'm sorry, it was a blast. It was an absolute blast. This is pre-internet, so it was the age of magazines being really beautiful things to own. I'm not against very high-end magazines like Vogue. I have a subscription to Vogue. I see it every month. And it gives you something that you don't have. So it's a taste of luxury in a very ordinary life. It costs the same as a coffee. If you're a journalist who's learning the ropes, that's one of the best ways to do it. You're with these extremely high-level creative people. You're not piddling around writing rubbish. I was interviewing artists and designers and musicians and writers all the time, going out all the time with friends, dressing up. I think it's healthy. If you're a young woman, I believe that you should be verbal and visible and vocal and go out and make yourself known. It's not a crime. But what I saw is that you have to be strategic. And I noticed, I was always so shrewd. I have no idea where I lost it since, but I was shrewd at the time. I noticed that some of the people in that sort of milieu, that world, never break out of it. I think it's great to be a star journalist when you're 20. I think it's not great when you're 50, 60, and 70. I think it's very easy to stay in that world forever. I think it's a shallow world. And you have to upgrade, you have to upscale. And then quite naturally, I moved on. Because my interests were very wide, and I was so political anyway, so I began working for the BBC very heavily, and working for the World Service is wonderful because you are literally receiving a line from Burundi and then you're speaking to someone about an Iranian soap opera, all in the same programme. And you become a bigger person when you do that. Once you've moved away from this kind of style, lifestyle journalism, you can't move back again. So the kind of work I did for newspapers was about women in society or about race or social issues. And it's just much more serious. You get a much bigger kickback. So you write one article about gender and you get 500 pieces of hate mail from some guy saying they're going to, you know, rape you and murder you and rape the pieces and put the pieces into a bucket and rape the bucket. I mean, all sorts of rubbish, basically. But that just means that you've hit a chord. And after that, you can't go back to writing about some fabulous exhibition that you saw because it just doesn't feel like you're making a social change. All of those magazines are now defunct. It's very sad because I think that paper and good design is really important. And now everything is online and people don't want to see lots and lots of big pictures online. They scroll down and they see text. So an entire segment of visual culture has gone. And I feel really sad about that. So if you're a graphic designer now, you have to be a digital graphic designer working for a screen, which might be a tiny little phone screen. So I really lament the loss of all of those wonderful publications. I edited one myself called The Stealth Corporation. It was beautiful, and we worked with wonderful photographers. I would never be able to do that again.
An issue recently in the media has been the Charlie Hebdo attack. What's your view on it?
I think that the attacks on the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists were straight up terrorism and murder. And there's no doubt in my mind. I have no apologism on behalf of the murderers. I think it's not just to do with fanaticism, it's to do with that plus a kind of really toxic machismo. And as much as you want to talk about female suicide bombers, the overwhelming majority of these terrorists are men who are puffed up with a sense that this is what makes you a man, being violent towards men, women, and children. So I don't have a lot to add about that. It bothers me, though, that on the same day as the attacks in Paris, Boko Haram massacred 2,000 people, and no one knows their names. There were no vigils for them. There was nothing. And instead, the Charlie Hebdo issue has then been inflamed into something about protecting communities. So the debate has now become about anti-Semitism. Right, I mean, I think the debate should be about anti-Semitism. I'm not arguing against that. And it's become about Islamophobia. But in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo massacre terrorist attack, there have been attacks on Muslims on the street. And, of course, people don't know who's a Muslim and who isn't. So this is not just about religion, it's about race as well. So they're basically an attacks on brown people because people are so ignorant that they think that if you're brown, you're automatically a Muslim. So it bothers me that we give attention to certain terrorist attacks and not certain other terrorist attacks. Having said that, of course the Charlie Hebdo attacks were an outrageous act of terrorism, but I feel that we should also be honouring the many, many victims of all attacks.
And is this what makes you angry now?
Yeah, I'm angry all the time, though. I mean, my first response to anything is to get incredibly angry about everything. I'm fiercely political. I think that what England has to do is join the dots together and realise that we live in a global world. I have a very, very global mindset. And I want to see that coming into the mainstream in England. Otherwise, England's going to wind up on the wrong side of history because the energy of the world is not in England and Western Europe at the moment. For me, the energy of the world is in China, it's in India. I went back to India for the first time in 20 years last year. It was amazing, so exciting, so dynamic. It's not just a place where people get raped. It's very, very exciting. I thought the young women there were so sisterly and so much fun. The energy is in the Middle East, North Africa region. The great buoyant economies are in African countries. And there's a lot that's exciting that's happening in Latin America. So this is not to do with England and France and Spain and America. And I would like to see the countries I've mentioned all kind of linking up. We need to get away from that sort of Live Aid mentality. You know, we live in a world which isn't just about different colours. We're of both sexes. We're all ages. We're all shapes and sizes. And yet, you know, you'll look down a conference table and it's 75% male and 95% white. And I think that's really strange because don't you tell me that there aren't people of colour and women and people of all ages who've got something to offer, because it's not true. And you look at governments who are very skewed in terms of race and gender, and they're doing a terrible job, so it's not as though they're genuinely the best ones. So it frustrates me, it really frustrates me, because of course I can walk out of this building and look on the street and look at the diversity of people, and then you go into the buildings of power, and we're speaking in an area which has lots of embassies, it's got lots of very big companies, work laterally, so it's about building networks and fighting for a voice and making yourself visible. And you do that by solidarity. Keep on pointing out that at the Oscars, in five different categories, it was all white men this year, which it was. And I've been doing lots of journalism about that for the last 3 days. You know, a film about Martin Luther King has a black woman director, doesn't even get nominated for Best Director. It's an amazing, cool woman. There's something's going on there. And you have to keep shouting and shouting and shouting. And if they don't like to hear, who cares? You know?
You're the patron of the Leeds Literary Prize for unpublished fiction by black and Asian women in the UK.
It's a form of endorsement, and what the prize is about looking at newspapers and looking at prizes and saying, hang on, are you telling me that non-white women can't write, or that we're thick, or that we're not publishing books? If you look at the books that are reviewed, if you look in the publishing industry at who gets the good deals, who gets the advances, who gets the book deals at all, it's still really unrepresentative of voices of colour and of voices of women. Unless you want to write, I hate the phrase chick lit, I think it's sexist. There's another phrase you can use called romantic realism, which I love. Unless you want to write in a genre like that, even then, that has no women of colour in it. So I think that there's a clear sense that unless you are writing a book about lotus blossoms and forbidden love in, what's an example? A noble woman in medieval Tehran, falls in love with the servant who's employed to clean the steps. You know, you write a very cliched book. You're unlikely to be heard. And whenever you put this to people in publishing, they say, oh, well, you know, women, people of colour, they're not putting themselves forward. The books aren't there. And I think prizes like the Leeds Literary Prize are a way of answering back and saying, well, those books and those voices are there. There are black women like Nnedi Okorafor writing African science fiction. There are people writing all kinds of genre work which doesn't fit the mould. And so you can't say that they're not there. Murder mysteries being sold everywhere. And that tradition of taking a risk on a new writer has gone. It used to be that you'd give them a few thousand pounds, you'd take a risk, and now that doesn't work. You need to have a hit. Hence my idea of Brown Game of Thrones.
I still think you should do that.
It's so amazing.
You've also mentioned that you're on the Man Booker Awards team.
Okay, so I'm one of about, I think, 11 trustees of the Booker Prize Foundation, and we look after the Booker Prize, but also the International Booker, and we have our fingers in various pies of other things to do with power and literature and literary achievement. We are overseers, so we can't rig the prize. I wish I could, but we can't rig the prize. We don't choose the jurors. There's another committee of many more people below us. But it's been a real insight for me into how power works. And that's why I think that we live in the world of the Tudors. We live in the world of the Elizabethan court. We meet three times a year. We sit around a table at a very nice, formerly gentlemen's club. Now I think that they admit women. And we make broad decisions based on what is the literary flavour, where we want to move the prize in the future. And it involves really high-level people. So one of the other trustees is an absolute heroine of mine, Helena Kennedy QC, who has spent her entire career working in human rights, writing about violence against women, looking at rape trials and the way rape survivors are treated in the criminal justice system. I can't believe that I'm across the table from people like that. And it took me 3 meetings before I found my voice. I'm the only person of colour on the team, and I was brought in, I think, because very rightly they felt that they should diversify in this kind of world that we live in, and of course I agree with that, but it's intimidating.
And what's next for you?
I am going to launch the new book, Asylum and Exile. I'm hopefully going back into fiction, which is a huge thing for me. I was very burnt after the first experience of it, and I'm hopefully working towards getting back into fiction and really pushing that. I love journalism more than anything, so I'll carry on working for the BBC. And I have been making jokes about doing something like Brown Game of Thrones throughout this interview, but I would like to go into mainstream fiction more. That's an absolute goal. I want to see if I can have a hit. Just to see if I can. I think people think that hit novels are written to a formula. I don't think that's true. I think it's really hard to have a hit. It's hard to break America. It's hard to have a bestseller. People who do it really are talented, and I want to see if I can do that. And I'd like to work on a very serious, large, epic series that completely absorbs me. When you're a journalist, your attention is defrayed in 100 different directions. So you do 20 different things in the course of a week. With fiction, you focus on one thing, and you go really deep. No one sees you doing it. You appear to be at home doing nothing. You are absorbed just with one idea, and if something happens in the world, you don't absorb it into your work, you ignore it. I find that really hard to do, but I also find it challenging, and I would love the challenge of working on a big fiction series, but I'm gathering up the courage. I used to be very courageous, and now I'm much more sort of afraid, but I would love to work on that for a few years.
Well, you'll be speaking at Asia House as part of your book launch.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to launching this book because it's always exciting when a book comes out, but particularly when it's about asylum and refuge, where you are talking about very current issues, these things that are in the papers now. Politicians are talking about them on the Today programme on Radio 4. And yet I think what we're proposing at Asia House is to get beyond the headlines and to break down the reality of being an asylum seeker. What does it really mean? I think what happens is people talk about asylum and exile and refuge, and they're really thinking about immigration. And those are actually different things. And then they talk about immigration, and they're really talking about religion, or they're talking about race and multiculturalism. and you very quickly get this debate sort of sliding all over the place. And I want to talk about the reality of asylum. What does it mean? It means turning up to a foreign country and saying, I don't have a visa. I'm asking for asylum. I'm asking to be recognized as a refugee. It's like throwing yourself on the mercy of another country's government. And we know what happens to asylum seekers. They're just detained. Very few asylum seekers are accepted. Most of them are bounced between prison and detention and treated atrociously. I don't think people know that. I want to bring those details to light in a very nuanced, humane way.
Padisha, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.